Welcome back to the Battle of Stalingrad podcast with me, Des Latham. This is episode 34 and the final in this series. A big thank you to my listeners who have posted reviews as well as comments over the past 9 months. So, to the story at hand. Last episode, you remember that Field Marshal Paulus surrendered with his men in the southern pocket inside Stalingrad. That was not the end of it all. We left off with Russian generals Voronov and Rokossovsky interrogating Paulus. Before we continue with their attempts at getting Paulus to order the Germans in the northern pocket in Stalingrad to surrender, we must quickly return to the Wolf's Lair in East Prussia. Hitler took the news of the surrender far more calmly than most would have forecast. Sitting in front of a huge map of Russia in the main conference room, he spoke with Zeitzler, Keitel, and others about the debacle. The Wolf's Lair in the middle of the Prussian forest was once described by General Jodl as the cross between a monastery and a concentration camp. Hitler didn't bother banging the table or conducting his usual screaming, haranguing technique. This time, he seemed resigned. "They have surrendered there formally and absolutely. Otherwise, they would have closed ranks, formed a hedgehog, and shot themselves with their last bullet. That Schmidt will sign anything." Hitler was referring to the supposedly ardent Nazi and Paulus's chief of staff. "A man who doesn't have the courage in such a time to take the road that every man has to take sometimes doesn't have the strength to withstand that sort of thing," Hitler droned on. "He will suffer torture in his soul." Hitler was disgusted. Zeitzler was his usual self, toading and coddling Hitler's ego. "I still think the Russians are only claiming to have captured them all." "No," shouted Hitler. "In this war, no more field marshals will be made. I won't go on counting my chickens before they were hatched." The Führer kept returning to the fact that Paulus failed to kill himself. In his mind, he'd built up the moment as one of heroic courage, something he could draw on to rally his Reich. Nobody, however, was more shocked than the Japanese. When their military officials were shown a Soviet propaganda film featuring Paulus and the other captured generals, they wondered why all had not committed suicide rather than be paraded around like criminals. Back in the interrogation room, Field Marshal Paulus continued refusing to call in the northern pocket to surrender. Voronov was running out of patience as he realized that Paulus was utterly naive about what his future would be, and he needed to cooperate to stop the carnage. "We are talking of a humanitarian act," said Voronov. "And this is even more the case because you yourself saved your life by surrendering." Paulus, who was a chain smoker, toyed with a packet of cigarettes as he blustered. "Even if I did sign such an order, they won't obey. If I surrendered, I automatically cease being their commander." Paulus's nervous tic in his face was jumping about as Voronov continued. "But you were the commander a few hours ago." The argument went round and round for ages. Voronov knew that back in Moscow, Stalin would be pacing around waiting to hear about the total surrender of all units. He began to sweat. His upper lip was twitching. Paulus continued to refuse. Eventually, Voronov pointed out, "Herr General Field Marshal, by your refusal to save the lives of your subordinates, you are taking on a heavy responsibility for the German people and the future of Germany." Voronov then called an end to the interrogation and asked Paulus in a moment of civility if he was hungry and if his lodgings were to his liking. Paulus said the lodgings were fine and asked Voronov to feed the German prisoners and provide medical support. Voronov said that may not be possible immediately. There were too many Soviet soldiers drawn into the fight for the northern pocket that needed feeding first. Paulus stood up, gave Voronov a half bow and left. Meanwhile, inside the Stalingrad northern pocket, 11th Corps Commander General Streckler was not giving up, along with stragglers of his six divisions. Streckler had based his few thousand men in the tractor plant, but their hours were numbered. A signal went out that troops are fighting without heavy weapons or supplies, men collapsing from exhaustion, freezing to death, still holding weapons, Streckler. Of course, many of these men were actually dying of starvation as well as exposure, let alone the wounds they were suffering. Hitler had something else to be positive about. Streckler may give him some form of honor by taking all his men to their death. "I expect the North Kessel to hold out to the last. 11 Army Corps must resist to the last to tie down as much enemy strength as possible to facilitate operations on other fronts," Hitler messaged Streckler back. But it wouldn't be long. Circling the pocket like ravenous hyenas were four Soviet armies that had been rapidly redeployed. They had concentrated 300 field guns in only half a mile, and the factory district was the target. They were flattening the bunker defenses from point-blank range, sometimes using flamethrowers as well as tanks. Strechler was convinced he was helping Manstein and the army group to the south in the Caucasus as they tried to escape the Soviet ring of steel, moving quickly towards the port city of Rostov. The one thing we must realize is that General Strechler was not trying to be a propaganda hero. He actually had considered his comrades facing annihilation in the south and truly believed his actions were slowing down the Red Army. And they were. In his mind, there was no doubt where the duties of an officer lay, though. This was clear from a published discussion he had with a regimental adjutant just before the end. "When the time comes," said the adjutant, "we will commit suicide." Strechler looked at him, startled. "Suicide?" he exclaimed. "Yes, Herr General, my colonel will also shoot himself. He believes we should not allow ourselves to be captured."
"Well, let me tell you something. You will not shoot yourself, nor will your colonel shoot himself. You will go into captivity along with your men, and you will do everything you can to set a good example."
"You mean," said the young officer, suddenly relieved, "I don't have to shoot myself?"
Then, on the morning of the 2nd February, 1943, Russian artillery concentrated around the northern pocket, opened fire. A number of German officers immediately surrendered, and Strechler realized the game was up. He drafted a final signal.
11 Army Corps has, with its 6 divisions, performed its duty down to the last man in heavy fighting. Long live Germany!
Someone in between there and the room back at the Wolfslehr in East Prussia changed the last line to "Long live the Führer!" before Hitler was handed the message. Back in the northern pocket, the shooting stopped. 2 Russian soldiers were nominated to approach the Germans in the tractor factory. To say they approached with trepidation would be an understatement. They were told to go away and bring back a general instead. The Russians now poured into the tractor factory assembly rooms, where hundreds of German wounded lay on shelves against the walls. Overhead, many bodies dangled from hastily constructed nooses. They were the Germans who feared capture and hanged themselves. When foreign journalists, including the remarkable Alexander Wirth, who I've mentioned a few times in this series, walked into the tractor factory a few days later, they were stunned by the utter carnage they found. Even experienced war correspondents were shocked into a dull silence. For one, the temperature was hovering between minus 30 and minus 40 degrees Celsius. So cold, you cannot breathe. The frozen air just cannot be processed by human lungs. Even steel becomes brittle. Everything freezes. Wirth described the trenches running through the factory yards where frozen German and Russian troops lay twisted together, mostly in fragments. Fragments and tortured bodies covered with girders and bricks. Wirth wrote that how anyone could have survived there was hard to imagine. So, at about 12:35, just after midday, Strechler was taken away by the Russians. Ironically, the final radio message from the 6th Army in Stalingrad was a weather report.
"Cloud base 15,000 feet. Visibility 7 miles. Clear sky. Occasional scattered nimbus clouds. Temperature minus 31 degrees centigrade. Over Stalingrad, fog and red haze. Meteorological station now closing down. Greetings to the homeland."
As the news of the final surrender of the 6th Army spread amongst the Russian 62nd Army, signal flares were fired in an impromptu display. Soldiers from the Volga flotilla and left bank then crossed over immediately with loaves of bread and tins of food for the thousands of civilians who were streaming out of their bunkers, cellars and holes. But it was a subdued group of Russian soldiers and civilians who embraced in the frigid air. The city felt deserted and dead. The numbers of casualties have been debated and denied, revisited and revised over the years. However, it's generally agreed that the Red Army suffered 1.1 million casualties, of which 485,751 were fatal. Alexander Wirth has some interesting numbers. These have been disputed at times, but he obtained them from the German quartermaster general von Kulawski, who'd fed, clothed and supplied the entire 6th Army. So please consider some of these details. By the final weeks, there were 195,000 German men to be supplied. 24 generals, including a field marshal, had been captured, along with 2,500 officers. The final number of prisoners taken by the Russians was around 130,000, and just between January the 10th and February, 60,000 Germans had been killed. More than 200,000 had died between November 1942 and February 1943. For the Wehrmacht, it was a time of counting the cost in other ways. 488 transport planes and 1,000 aircrew had died during the attempted airlift alone. The 9th Flak Division had been destroyed along with all ground personnel. The 4th Air Fleet lost most of their bombers, fighters and Stukas during the campaign. The exact German losses remain somewhat unknown, as I said. Of course, the Russians have grossly inflated these, saying between January and February 1943, the Germans lost 1,550 tanks in Stalingrad. There were fewer than 200 still operating, so we can confidently ignore Soviet grandiose propaganda. And yet, these arguments are really red herrings. Stalingrad set up what would be a catastrophe for the German people as the Russians took horrible revenge. Stalingrad was also the most catastrophic loss by any German army in history up to that point. The 6th Army and the 4th Panzer Army had effectively been obliterated. German propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels had a big problem. Using his talent for shameless distortion, he'd forced those in the Nazi Party to avoid speaking about the 6th Army encirclement. Now he boasted through propaganda reports published in Germany that not a single man survived. They'd all fought to the death. The tragedy was to be honored, he said. No dancing allowed. Cinemas closed down. The press in Berlin were briefed about how to refer to the Germans fighting Bolsheviks. They were not Russians. The defeat must be treasured, he said. The official statement from the Nazis was as follows.
From Führer Headquarters, 3rd February 1943. The Supreme Commander of the Wehrmacht announces that the Battle of Stalingrad has come to an end. True to its oath of allegiance, the 6th Army, under the exemplary leadership of Field Marshal Paulus, has been annihilated by the overwhelming superiority of enemy numbers. They died so that Germany might live.
A period of 3 days of national mourning was ordered. Solemn music was played on radio stations. At the same time, newspapers were told to avoid black margins and no flags were to be flown at half-mast. It was, in some ways, a victory. But these lies, as most do in the face of overwhelming truth, backfired. Particularly the lie about the whole 6th Army dying bit. Germans were now aware, through word of mouth, and some who were monitoring outside radio, that at least 91,000 Germans were prisoners of war. This caused a knock-on effect. The average German began tuning into foreign radio broadcasts more regularly, just in case. And the imprisoned Germans who had survived the terrible marches, which I'll describe in a moment, were allowed to write postcards home. When the Germans refused to allow these to be distributed, the Russians resorted to dropping copies on German lines on the Eastern Front. Some of the soldiers there then sent anonymous letters to the families using the addresses provided, signing themselves as German Patriot or XXX. To the horror of the Nazis, families who received these messages from loved ones contacted others in the same situation. In Berlin and other German cities, graffiti began to appear, some with messages like, "Enjoy the war, the peace will be much worse." Amazingly, a student campaign known as the White Rose began in Munich and spread rapidly to Hamburg, Berlin, Stuttgart and Vienna. Leaflets and slogans called for the overthrow of the Nazis. Many of these students were arrested starting on the 18th of February 1943. These students were then tortured to death, and the main organizers, brother and sister Sophie and Hans Scholl, were beheaded. Their professor of philosophy, Kurt Huber, was executed. These are the honorable people of German history and should be remembered. It was now that Hitler virtually disappeared from public view. Guderian wrote later of this time and saw that the dictator's left hand trembled more, his back was more bent, his gaze became fixed, eyes protruding but lacking luster, cheeks flecked with red. We now know that Hitler's doctor was shooting him up with a concoction of drugs which worsened his mental condition, already shattered by Stalingrad. In Russia, Lieutenant General Rokossovsky and Chief of Staff Lieutenant General Malinin wrote their final report to Stalin from Stalingrad, which read,
Carrying out your order, the troops of the Don Front at 4 p.m. on February 3, 1943, completed the rout and the destruction of the encircled group of enemy forces in Stalingrad. 22 divisions had been destroyed or taken prisoner. The military operations in the city and the area of Stalingrad have ceased.
But the killing on the Russian part did not. The death rate of the German prisoners proves this. Of the 91,000 taken prisoner at the end of the battle, almost half were dead by spring, that is May 1943. The death rate in the so-called Russian hospitals was worse. Most frostbite victims eventually died of gangrene. Second-line Russian troops shot medics just to steal their drugs. Misery brings scum to the surface, and it was also German scum rising to exploit the helplessness of their former comrades. Everything that could be stolen was watches, rings, bracelets. Then the law of poetic justice ran its course. These wounded who were robbed were suffering from typhus, which was passed from the stolen item to the thief, who inevitably died. For almost a week after the surrender, the Russians did not feed their prisoners, who by then hadn't eaten for 2 weeks. Then the Russian death marches began, and those who died first were the biggest, the heftiest, the most Aryan-looking, if you like. Shorter, slight men survived best. During these death marches, the cleverest would ensure they were in the front of the column nearest their Russian soldier escorts, or they could be attacked by civilians who stole their clothes and killed them. Other Russian troops indulged in a kind of sport, taking pot shots for fun at the columns, seeing how many men they could drop with one shot. The Germans themselves had indulged in a similar practice since June 1941, so it was payback time. The Russians took tens of thousands of prisoners on a zigzag route, starting from the Tsaritsa Ravine in Stalingrad via Gumrak Airfield to Gorondichka, then ending up at Beketovka. A two-day march, the Red Army turned into 5 days in minus 30 degrees centigrade weather. Some Russian peasants took pity on these men, throwing them bread, but most spat at them or had to be physically held back as they sought vengeance for a loved one. A soldier from the German 305th Infantry Division described later how he and 1,200 men had set off on this march. Only 120 were alive when they arrived in Beketovka. 50,000 Lanzas were crammed into Beketovka. By October 1943, 45,200 of those were dead. By spring of 1943, the Russians had been dealing with 235,000 prisoners in total, including members of Manstein's attempted relief operations, Romanians, and many other allies of the Germans. The generals were first to leave these death centers. They were taken to a specialist camp near Moscow. Bitterness grew between former allies. Austrians told the Russians they were actually communists and had been brainwashed by the fascists. They followed a diaspora to keep these prisoners far from prying eyes. 20,000 were herded off to Bekabad, east of Tashkent. 2,500 went to Volsk, northeast of Saratov. 5,000 down the Volga to Astrakhan. 2,000 to Usman, near Voronezh. Others herded off to Bazyanovsky, Gorky, Karaganda. Many prisoners lied about their previous professions, saying agricultural labourer on the notes that they wrote, in the hope they would end up on farms. Most thought after the horrors of Beketovka and the other gathering points that the worst was over as they began to be moved to their isolated camps around Russia. Of course, it wasn't. Thousands more died on these journeys. They were given no water. Corpses were stacked close to the sliding doors of the cattle trucks. Each stop, they would offload their dead comrades. Some of these journeys by rail lasted 25 days, with the longest heading to Uzbekistan. In some of those cattle trucks, of the 100 men who'd been crammed into each, fewer than 10 survived. Of the 100,000 Italians who went into prison after Stalingrad, 12,000 survived. Stalin's oppression of his own people, of course, continued until he died of a stroke in 1953. So what of Paulus and the others? First, Manstein. Foiled in his attempt to rescue the Sixth Army, Manstein performed a miracle by holding the port city of Rostov open until mid-February 1943, allowing most of the German Army Group A in the Caucasus to escape entrapment. But he was sacked by Hitler in 1944 over grand strategy differences. then faced war crimes charges for permitting the notorious Einsatzgruppen to exterminate Jews within his territorial command. Exonerated there, he wrote a controversial memoir blaming Paulus for not breaking out of the Kessel. Of course, Manstein was equally to blame, as he never had the courage to give Paulus the order. By August 1943, three generals, Seydlitz, Lattmann, and Kors, were regarded by the Russians as collaborators and re-educated. They were sent to Vojkovo to win over the other generals. General Streckler, though, was disgusted. He, along with Sixt von Arnim, Rodenburg, and Pfeiffer, accused the three of treason. But generals Edler von Daniels, Drebber, and Schlomer joined the pro-Russian group. By 1944, Paulus finally agreed to sign a declaration to the German people calling on them to oppose Hitler, which of course triggered the Führer's rage. Paulus' son Friedrich was a captain who had been killed at Anzio in Italy in February 1944, which may have led to the field marshal deciding enough was enough. His other son, Ernst Alexander, was then arrested in Germany and thrown into a concentration camp. His wife, Elena Constance Paulus, was told by the Gestapo that if she renounced her husband, she would be spared. Amazingly, she scornfully and literally turned her back on the Gestapo interrogating her, who promptly marched Elena off to a concentration camp too. For the rest of his life, Paulus lived behind the Iron Curtain. During the Nuremberg trials in 1946, Paulus appeared as a witness where the Soviet press then referred to him as the ghost of Stalingrad. He was kept prisoner and could not return to any life he had known. Paulus, of course, aged rapidly. Then his wife, Elena, died in 1947. As the Cold War gained momentum, the Soviets began executing greater numbers of German prisoners, specifically from Stalingrad. In 1949, another Stalin purge swept the USSR, and German prisoners of war were once again targeted for special attention. By 1955, there were almost 10,000 German POWs still languishing in Russia, including 2,000 from Stalingrad. They were finally set free in November 1955, 10 years after the war ended, 12 years after Stalingrad fell. Seydlitz paid dearly for dealing with the Russians. He was ostracized back in Germany. Everyone avoided him. He died alone in 1956, having returned to live in Russia. Paulus remained holed up in Russia, writing paper after paper, trying to exonerate himself, until he was released in 1953, when he left for the East German city of Dresden that had been so terribly bombed by the Allies during the war. Paulus died in Dresden in 1957. His remains were brought to West Germany, where he is buried next to his wife in Baden-Baden. His opponent in Stalingrad, General Chuikov, fought with the 62nd Army all the way to Berlin, where he then became commander of the Russian forces occupying Germany. Eventually made a marshal of the Soviet Union, Chuikov was deputy minister of defense under Khrushchev, also a Stalingrad vet, as we know. Following his death in 1982, Chuikov was interred at the Stalingrad Memorial at Mamyev Kurgan, which had been the site of so much heavy fighting. That accursed hill, around and on which so many men succumbed, now bears the grave of the man who probably is mainly instrumental in stopping the Germans from seizing the city. As the Battle of Stalingrad and this podcast series ends, there is one image that burned into my memory. While the city was nothing but a battered and burned skeleton on February 1943, the only landmark left standing was to become the symbol of Russian resistance and will continue for many years into the future. That was the fountain with statues of little boys and girls dancing around it. This seemed a miracle after so many thousands of children had died in the ruins all around this unsettling statue. If you haven't seen the photograph, try and find it. You'll see what a miracle it was. This delicate statue survived when all about are shattered ruins. It's the spirit of life that shone through this disaster of the human condition, this battle that plumbed the depths of human depravity and changed the world forever. Please look out for a couple of my other podcasts, one called The Anglo-Boer War, the other Plane Crash Diaries. There will also be two new series beginning in February 2021, South African Border Wars and the History of South Africa. So to all my friends around the world who have sent me messages and suggestions, queries, complaints, corrections, and congratulations, thanks to you all. Goodbye.